Good morning to you all. Welcome to the seventh lecture of the 2017 Palliative Care Lecture Series. Hospice New Zealand would like to thank and acknowledge the Genesis Oncology Trust for their generous support and funding to deliver these free lectures. The lecture today will be recorded and will be available on the Hospice New Zealand website. Please be aware there will be an opportunity for questions at the end of the presentation. We would now like to introduce our guest speaker today, Dr. Martin Woods. Martin has worked as a nurse and as a university lecturer in three different countries, United Kingdom, New Zealand, and Papua New Guinea, in the past few decades. He is the New Zealand Consultant for Ethics and Human Rights with the International Council of Nurses and Research Fellow at Mary Potter Hospice Wellington. He has published nearly 50 articles in the professional and academic journals and in 8 book chapters. He is currently researching nursing viewpoints both nationally and internationally on euthanasia. Welcome, Martin. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everybody. It's nice to be with you all. The topic for today is euthanasia, which in recent times I described, I think, as a poison chalice, which is probably not the best way to describe it, I suppose, on reflection. But it is an extraordinarily complicated and complex topic. Before I start, of course, I should add that the Select Committee's report has now been released this very evening before the lecture, and you can all read the report on the government's website. It's about 50 pages long. It is described as the entire topic of euthanasia is from my perspective anyway, quite a complex and complicated affair, and everyone's encouraged to now read it. We've been looking at the topic of euthanasia for the past few months, if not years sometimes, it seems like. But certainly the topic has now come to full fruition with the Select Committee report. It's also been, of course, drawn out of the hat or selected by Parliament to be debated as a bill, and it will have its first reading at some point, probably after the elections, as everybody's predicted. So the topic is very topical, as they say, very hot, and it's one that's concerned a lot of nurses around the country, a lot of doctors, and a lot of palliative care workers of various descriptions. Slide number 2. There are 3 objectives, of course, to this workshop. We could spend an hour on each of these, of course, and you must bear with me when I say that we can only do what we can do in a short period of time. The general idea here this morning, of course, is to present you with some current ideas and thoughts about the topic so that you can then discuss these amongst yourselves back in the settings that you're working within, back in the hospices and so on. So basically, we're going to try and present a brief overview of the current practices of end-of-life or euthanasia. We're going to examine the main issues associated with assisted dying or euthanasia. Notice this duality of terminology creeping in already. And to review research about what health-related professionals think about these issues. There is quite a bit of research out there, but some of it, of course, has been mainly with members of the public, and how much research has been done amongst doctors and nurses is an interesting debate. Slide number 3. So what's happening now? Most of you will probably know that in many ways the practice of euthanasia has been around for some time in certain countries. For instance, the Netherlands and Belgium have had this euthanasia practice for at least the last decade or two. At Luxembourg as well, the Low Countries essentially, but also places like Colombia, which is fairly recent, and for some a bit of a surprise, being a sort of a country in Latin America where one would not normally associate the practice. However, assisted suicide, which is not quite the same thing as human euthanasia, is of course legal in Switzerland and Germany and Japan and recently Canada. And in a few United States, such as Washington, Oregon, Colorado, Vermont, Montana, and so on. The Oregon legislation was passed some years ago, but some of the other states are fairly recent. There has been a lot of interest in euthanasia practices in Belgium, mainly because the Belgians of all of these countries have pursued euthanasia with what you might call some vigour in recent years. And recently, one of the most controversial moves that's occurred was the Belgian Parliament agreed that children should have the same right as adults to die with dignity, as they called it, and the lawmakers have passed a bill to allow euthanasia for very rare cases in a terminally ill child. And so it's an example of the extent of the legislation and its development, if you like, in these countries. However, it's worth remembering, before we go any further, that whilst these countries have legislated for euthanasia, there are quite a number of countries who have legislated against euthanasia. In recent times, for instance, the assisted dying bill in Britain was rejected by a majority of 2-thirds to 1, so quite a large rejection in Britain. In Scotland, a similar attempt was legislated against, failed to get through their parliament and so on. And in a number of US states, other than the ones we mentioned, obviously, attempts have been made to pass legislation, and they failed, sometimes only failing by 1 or 2 votes, so close call in some situation. Slide number 4, in the Netherlands, for instance, it's worth remembering that when we're talking about euthanasia, there are some differences. In the Netherlands, patients' suffering must be unbearable with no prospect of improvement. So these are the legislated rules, if you like. The suffering need not be related to a terminal illness, need not be limited to physical suffering such as pain. And so there's quite a broad brush approach in the Netherlands, and Belgian law is quite similar too. The patient's suffering must be constant and unbearable, resulting from a serious and incurable disorder. There is no requirement that the patient be diagnosed with a terminal illness. And so in the Netherlands and Belgium, and I think possibly Luxembourg as well, the legislation is fairly broad brush and will allow for a number of instances where we're not talking about an incurable terminal disease at all, but some other condition which can include conditions such as advanced dementia and the like. In Canada, patients will qualify for assistance if they have a grievous or irremediable medical condition that causes an enduring and intolerable suffering, and so a slightly more refined explanation there, arguably. And the 5 US states actually only permit assisted dying, they don't permit euthanasia in the sense that we understand the meaning of the word. So the patient must be terminally ill, no additional requirement relating to the patient's experience of the disease or any minimal level of suffering, simply that they must be terminally ill. And so around the world, euthanasia legislation has been introduced. The general idea is the idea that someone who has a significant severe illness, sometimes terminal in some cases, in other cases not, has the right to request a doctor, nearly always it goes through the medical profession, to terminate their lives under certain circumstances, and there are rules and regulations written into all of these laws to allow this to happen. In a similar way, New Zealand has been considering something like this, perhaps similar to the Canadians in a sense, depending upon how you read the proposed legislation, to allow people to end their lives in New Zealand under those circumstances. Interestingly enough, there are some statistics, slide number 5, and these statistics from Belgium, of course, have shown that over the years since the legislation has been operating, the number of cases of euthanasia has gradually risen year by year. It's a similar story in the Netherlands, and I suppose it's a similar story in the other countries and states in America that we've mentioned. Gradually, more and more cases are appearing. In some cases, of course, in Belgium and the Netherlands in particular, not all of these cases are people who have what you might call a fatal terminal illness. There are some other instances where they do have a sort of a debilitating, a seriously debilitating illness, which has also been taken into account. There are cases of people with dementia now being involved in euthanasia practice. Slide number six. I have attempted in this brief presentation to consider some of the main issues with the euthanasia debate. We are in this country going to have further debates about this topic. We're going to have further discussions between ourselves and possibly with members of the general public as well, and sometimes with some of the people that we might come into contact with within the services that we offer, because the euthanasia debate is now fixed in place and it's not going to go away, and certainly will linger for the next few months until, of course, Parliament has considered the bill and considered the legislation and made a decision one way or the other. But even then, after that, of course, the debates will continue, and various institutions like hospices, for instance, will have to have some sort of an opinion about this situation and some sort of policy considerations in mind if such a time does arise as to when they have to make some sort of a response to legislation, if it appears. So the main issues for now, anyway, from my perspective at least, and there are lots of arguments about what the main issues should include. If you read the report from the Health Select Committee, you'll notice that they too have struggled to try and identify all of the main issues and deal with them in entirely comprehensive ways. Their report's actually only 50 pages long, which to me is a bit of a surprise. I imagine something rather more substantial than that. And it also has no recommendations, by the way, another factor which has to be taken into account in the future, I think, by all hospices and people working in palliative care, because, of course, at some point we're going to have some sort of set of policy conclusions as to how we might proceed if and when legislation does appear. But anyway, the main issues in my way of thinking about it, there has always been a language issue with this topic. Doctors and nurses, it's found in the literature, tend to still talk about euthanasia per se and suicide, and words like assisted suicide and even physician-assisted suicide, which in many ways literally describes what seems to be the case. However, there are others who would argue that the language itself is very important in this debate, and that certain language suggests certain responses that are not necessarily desirable. And so alternative language has appeared in the debate as well, and that alternative language includes things like assisted dying, physician-assisted dying or physician-aided dying, physician-assisted death, physician aid in dying or medical aid in dying, and other languages used as well, such as dying with dignity, the right to die, and compassionate dying, which all offer, if you like, a slightly softer approach to the terminology used in what is still, to some at least, the major topic of euthanasia. So in many ways, definitions and language are both rather important. We can't talk about this topic too well without necessarily checking just how we use language and what exactly we mean when we do use certain definitions and words. Slide number seven. It's always a good start, in my opinion at least, to remember that normally when talking about euthanasia, we are talking about a situation that is to be applied when there are obvious signs that life is coming to an end. So end of life is a stage that has to be carefully defined. Normally, for most purposes, and this is from the General Medical Council of Britain, the patients are approaching the end of life when they're likely to die within the next 12 months. So there's quite a long time period in many ways. It's not necessarily an imminent thing whatsoever, but there's a time period involved. This includes patients whose death is imminent, or those who, of course, whose death might be further down the track. But certainly those with advanced, progressive, incurable conditions is a common phenomenon in any of the euthanasia legislation. General frailty and coexisting conditions, which is slightly less common in euthanasia legislation in some countries, but is a possibility in some of them. Existing conditions, if they're at risk from dying from a sudden acute crisis, which is not particularly part of this discussion, and life-threatening acute conditions caused by a catastrophic event, also not really part of this situation about euthanasia. But A and B have certainly become major arguments for a type of euthanasia legislation to be introduced into various countries. Defining euthanasia, of course, therefore, can be quite an interesting problem. And there are several definitions, really, all of them concentrating around similar elements, if you like. Euthanasia in this definition, for instance, is an act where a third party, and that's normally the case, usually implied to be a physician, in nearly all cases it is, terminates the life of a person either passively or actively. Many of you will be familiar, I would imagine, with the idea of euthanasia as a passive or active thing, the definition extending into either area, you know, to mean slightly different things. Obviously, passive euthanasia is different from active euthanasia, and that passive euthanasia is simply applied to a person whether or not they are aware that this is happening. Active euthanasia has a more sort of involved element for all individuals, if you like. And there are other arguments about passive and active euthanasia as well as to exactly what they might mean. But in part, it's become a highly topical issue. In recent decades, mainly, in the past, of course, this was never necessarily a major argument in any society, but it's certainly become a major argument in recent decades because, of course, we now have situations where, for instance, people describe their situation as living in a situation that they consider to be worse than death. Rather dramatic language, actually, from the Bioethics University, but the University of Minnesota, but there it is. Or they're in a protracted coma, or they're in a persistent vegetative state. I suppose in many ways, it's A that's become the major talking point in any euthanasia debate. What is a situation considered to be worse than death? And I suppose if you look at the opinion polls of the general public, at least, they consider that kind of situation to be someone who's living, say, with intractable pain, or with a disease which is causing them serious physical and psychological harm that they wish to end earlier than perhaps would be the case if things were allowed to take their natural course. So euthanasia has its definitions, and there are some debates about exactly what is meant by the term euthanasia, but all I can tell you at the moment is that it's still quite a common term, no matter what the anti-euthanasia, no matter what the pro-euthanasia lobbies argue it should be called. It's still a term that's commonly used in many, many jurisdictions and by many professionals, health professionals around the world. It's still used. Assisted death, which is a term now which has become slightly more common, or assisted dying, which is part of what we're now talking about in New Zealand, is a form of euthanasia in which an individual expresses a wish to die. This is slide number 9. Expresses a wish to die prematurely and is helped to accomplish that goal by another person, either by counselling, which is not particularly that common, and or by providing a poison or other lethal instrument. And so assisted death in this instance, and in this particular definition anyway, literally means that an individual requires the assistance of someone else to assist them to die. The assisted death may be regarded as homicide, of course, or suicide by local authorities, and the person giving the assistance may be responsible for the death if, of course, in that country there is no legislation to permit euthanasia. And so we can see from our use of terminology and from whether or not that terminology has backing in legislation, that on the one hand it can be seen as a type of acceptable euthanasia or assisted death, and on the other hand it can be seen as some kind of homicide or suicide. And so there are some issues there to be considered. Slide number 10. The most commonly talked about form of assisted dying or assisted death is physician-assisted suicide, or physician-assisted dying, as some people now would refer it to. The word suicide is considered to be too controversial and too damning, if you like, of the act itself. But with physician-assisted dying or suicide, a doctor provides a patient with prescription for drugs that a patient could use to end their own life. The main distinction between physician-assisted suicide and active euthanasia is that the doctor is not the person physically administering the drugs. So in active euthanasia, a person is actively, actively killed, really, by another person. But with assisted suicide, the doctor provides the means, but the person themselves then performs the act, or a person appointed by the person themselves performs the act. Physician-assisted suicide, then, is only contemplated by and would only be considered as an option for patients who are conscious and capable of making their own decisions. This is the idea with physician-assisted suicide. Although in the Netherlands and Belgium, as we mentioned earlier, in recent times, there have been a number of cases now where some patients have not been capable of making their own decisions and have been assisted in such a fashion. And there are obviously ongoing debates about this. And it's indeed one of the anxieties that's presented in the report to Parliament. Several people in that report argued that they're worried more by the possibilities of extending a euthanasia situation that would go well beyond conscious and capable people making their own decisions, and they're worried about what's called a slippery slope, what might happen if people suddenly are involved who are not capable of doing those things, as seems to be gradually occurring in, say, the Netherlands and Belgium. The justification for physician-assisted suicide, of course, the primary ethical arguments at least, is that this allows autonomy and self-empowerment of the patient, and autonomy and self-empowerment is a big argument within the pro-euthanasia lobby in New Zealand and in other countries as well. It shows compassion and mercy, which is another major argument, and of course it provides freedom from suffering. All of these three arguments were commonly seen in the submissions to our own parliament and have commonly been seen in submissions around the world for the use of physician-assisted suicide, and in some countries these arguments have clearly won the day and legislation has been passed. In other countries, though, alternative arguments such as the slippery slope argument have also been powerful arguments and clearly have steered legislation against. Slide number 12. There are some debates, and I have found this in my own research, and we're going to talk about research shortly, but there are some debates about what exactly we could mean by active euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide or physician-assisted dying, and what the legal alternatives might be already. In many ways, some people even argue that some of these legal alternatives are a form of euthanasia. And this certainly comes up in research and is a major form of definable confusions at the moment, I would say. So if a patient refuses an intervention, of course, they have a legal right to do so, and some intervention is either withdrawn or never delivered in the first place, such as chemotherapy or medications or whatever, then some argue that that's sort of a patient selecting their own demise, and it's a form of euthanasia. But of course, this is not necessarily accepted by many. A refusal of an intervention has been established well in the law for decades, really, and is seen as a natural right of any patient in any setting, and is not necessarily the same thing as euthanasia at all. Similar refusal of food or fluid. If a patient refuses such things, then force feeding is not acceptable. It's against the law, because the patient has a right to withdraw, not just from medical and other interventions, health-related interventions, but also from food or fluid should they see fit. The most contentious of this list, I suppose, is palliative sedation, and I've definitely got research evidence in recent times to suggest that some nurses, at least, and it's been research on nurses that I'm talking about, think that palliative sedation is a form of euthanasia. The literature tells us otherwise, but then again, there are some differences of opinion that are obviously still not being resolved here. But palliative sedation is for those with unbearable and unmanageable pain, or other symptoms that are intractable, who is approaching their last hours or days of their life, and it's the maintenance of a state of sedation that's considered to be legally acceptable. This approach has an ethical basis that derives from the importance of an intended effect over possibly secondary or unintended consequences. And I suppose it's palliative sedation that brings to mind the argument of double effect, as is the use of opioids, I suppose, in large doses. The argument of double effect, remember, in this debate, does occur from time to time and is mentioned in various documents relating to the possible legislation or not of euthanasia, and it's simply this, that in any sort of situation it is permissible to argue that to prevent serious pain and suffering one can use certain resources such as palliative sedation or large doses of opioids to relieve that pain, even if there is a possible side effect of that person then not eating or drinking as they might normally have done, or even that large doses of opioids over a long period of time may have some effect upon, a secondary effect upon the length of the patient's life, although, as we all know, large doses of opioids have been carefully explained by several sources now to have no such particular effect. But there is this idea anyway, at least with palliative sedation, that possibly a patient receiving palliative sedation is in a way taking part in some sort of situation that is associated with euthanasia. The opioid argument, by the way, was used by John Key a year or two back, who said, I think, in an interview, that he believed that we were performing euthanasia, acts of euthanasia anyway, in around the country because of the large doses of opioids that were used. So there's still this sort of general belief, at least in the general public, that such large doses of opiates do have this effect and do therefore contribute to an earlier death. And so whether health professionals understand this or not, there's still this perception in the general public. Slide number 13. The concept of death, therefore, with dignity, which is often the words used in euthanasia legislation, allowing a person to retain dignity as they die, is a very popular argument for those who support active euthanasia. The idea stems from the notion that prolonged death in a medical setting is unnatural and undignified, and encouraging death with dignity will allow people to opt out, as it were, from such a situation and be given the chance to choose the time of their own death and to choose the circumstances of their own death and to take control, as it were, of that particular aspect of their life. There are contents of the draft bill that everyone should be aware of, at least around the country. The draft bill is supposed to contain safeguards. For instance, people who want to opt for euthanasia would need to be mentally competent. Well, that was the case in the Netherlands and Belgium, remember, in the first stages of euthanasia legislation, but that was relaxed over a period of time, and that's another argument, by the way, and signed off by two doctors who would testify that it was actually a clear choice, the individual concerned understood the consequences, etc., etc. The requesting individual would also need to suffer a terminal illness, which was likely to cause death within 12 months. So in this legislation, in our draft bill, as it were, there are these provisions and terms, of course, which tend to make it fairly clear, similar, I think, perhaps to the Canadian legislation in many ways, you know, that there has to be a particular situation of terminal illness before euthanasia or assisted dying can be permitted. Slide number 15. What would happen if legislation was passed in New Zealand? The idea would be, basically, that a person would make a request to a doctor. They would not necessarily be required to discuss this with family or friends. They would be given a time for reflection, a minimum of 7 days. In some jurisdictions, this could be longer or shorter, but 7 days is considered to be relatively normal. They'd have to complete a written or signed request. They'd have to nominate another person than the medical practitioner, or they can nominate another person to carry out and assist in the act, which is an interesting aspect, by the way. They must state absence of coercion, clearly. They may choose the procedure. They may choose who's to be present at the procedure. They can choose where it will take place. They can delay or cancel the procedure. The medical practitioner is not necessarily required to be present. If the person is unable to self-administer, of course, a medical practitioner has to do the administration of the lethal dose to allow death to occur. And so there's quite a lot of responsibility in the draft bill, as in jurisdictions or legislation in other countries, placed upon physicians. However, there is some nervousness and anxiety amongst nurses as well in all of this. Whilst the certifying medical practitioner, slide number 16, receives a request, of course, and encourages the person to discuss with others and observe the 7 days and complete certificates and so on, all the things that the doctor would have to carry out, there are some anxieties amongst nursing profession as to exactly what is the role of the nurse, because in the legislation as it stands, nursing is not actually mentioned at all. One final point about the medical practitioner that I think is worth remembering just while we're going through this. Refusing a request has to result in referring to another doctor who, in the draft that I've seen anyway, who has to agree to pass this on and find someone suitable. For some of our doctors in some of our hospices, maybe many, I think this might be an issue which has to be considered should and when legislation be considered. But what about the nurse? The certifying doctor may delegate to another nominated person, and this is where it's thought possible, quite possible, that nurses may be involved at that level. The assistance or task can be delegated only with the agreement of the dying person who's made the request. However, the delegated person may be a health professional or a lay person, and so there may be nursing involvement at that level. If this is not necessarily the case, then nurses at least will probably be involved in preparation of the lethal dose and or in preparation of the patient and their family before the event. There's more to the act than meets the eye, and more to the act that meets the eye in the draft bill that's not exactly recorded, but there's more implications there for nurses than perhaps some might think. What are the legal and moral arguments, therefore, for such a bill, for such a piece of legislation? Legally speaking, this is slide number 17, euthanasia always requires the act of another party. Clearly, a person cannot perform this legalized euthanasia alone. That would simply be suicide otherwise. When more than one person is involved in a sequence of actions that results in death, then under the law, of course, that death would be termed a suicide when the last person who acts in the sequence is the one who dies, clearly. So we are now talking about a legal definition at the moment that that reflects suicide rather than active legalized euthanasia. If the last actor is someone other than the one who dies, at the moment in this country, legally speaking, that person is involved in what's called a homicide, and therefore is guilty under the Crimes Act and could be prosecuted. And so clearly, legally speaking, anyway at the moment, no one can take part in such an act within the law. The argument going through Parliament and going through the Select Committee and going through the country at the moment is that this should be overturned and euthanasia made legal, and therefore the Crimes Act would have to be revised, etc., etc. Morally speaking, of course, the term euthanasia implies, literally, in its early origins from the Greek, a good death. And therefore any act should, if you like, have the criteria of goodness attached to it. This is what the pro-euthanasia lobby has been arguing, basically, that in actual fact this is a good thing to do in a moral sense. It is a desirable thing, rather than something which should be shunned by society. In the case of euthanasia, the motive is usually noted as one of mercy, being a core value, which is thought to be altruistic. And so it's explained, if you like, as a type of mercy. Indeed, some general public still refer to the act of euthanasia as mercy killing, based upon the idea that it's better to do this than to allow someone's life to continue as they see it in severe distress and so on. Such criteria may be that it's swift and relatively painless and causes minimum psychological suffering and is therefore far more desirable, if you like, than to allow someone to linger. We haven't really got time today, slide number 18, to discuss the ethics. We'd need another 2 or 3 hours minimum, but I have put down here a sort of a binary explanation of the main arguments, morally speaking, between the pro and the anti-euthanasia lobbies. Essentially, you could argue that those who are against the act of euthanasia are, in one way or another, defending an ethical position that's loosely, if not maybe more fully, based on the idea of sanctity of life. Sanctity of life arguments are generally all about the innate value of humankind that should not be tampered with in ways which go beyond the natural laws of humankind, if you like, and therefore killing is not to be supported in any particular shape or form. It does have theological connections, if you like, but then again, so do a great number of people around the world have theological connections. They do have belief systems. And of course, this kind of an argument has been relatively commonly used for centuries rather than for decades. In more recent times, there are those who have been arguing that, in actual fact, rather than the innate value of life, we must consider the quality of the human life and the autonomy of the individual, their right to choose. And indeed, we have heard some arguments from some people saying we wouldn't do this to an animal. Therefore, you know, surely a human being should have the same right to choose euthanasia should their quality of life become unbearable. There are some issues with the quality of life arguments, of course. And remember, this is just a binary split. Many issues are caught somewhere between these two rather than it's either one or the other. But, of course, quality of life is highly subjective. There are multiple possibilities to the arguments of a quality of life. What exactly do you mean by quality of life. How exactly do you measure someone's quality of life? Is someone who is severely debilitated and unable to communicate, do they have any quality of life, or who is to judge what quality of life might be? And so there are many ethical arguments between sanctity and quality of life, and many arguments in between, by the way, that are of ethical concern. Some of these arguments, quite a few I suppose, are considered in the Select Report, and therefore it would be a good thing at some point for everybody to try and read the Select Report to develop their appreciation of what the ethical issues finally include. However, I do want now, slide 19, to move on to the euthanasia debate and public opinion, because, and generally to move into research. In recent years, the softening of the argument towards euthanasia has been matched in opinion polls. Previous surveys have shown a gradual trend towards this preference, and some of the last bastions of resistance, as they've been described, seem to be members of various national bodies, which includes physicians and nurses, and various religious organizations, but not necessarily all. So we're now moving just for the last few slides into just a quick look at what the main arguments and legislation tells us. Slide number 20. Euthanasia therefore remains focused around a change to the law to allow terminally ill patients or those whose quality of life has diminished to an unacceptable extent the right to a peaceful death. Or the alternative argument, even if it's done for a good reason, it's still killing, and that's obviously from the Catholic bishops of New Zealand, but it is a sort of an example, if you like, of that general sanctity of life position versus the quality of life position in a rather crude format here, but in general, those are the main arguments. So we've ended up with two camps in New Zealand, is what I'm trying to say here. For a small nation of just over 4 million people, we do seem to have a major binary split, I will admit, between, generally speaking, members of the general public, it seems, and the health professions. Although this is rather a crude way of defining things, there are variations in between. But let's just have a quick look, slide number 22, about where we seem to be, as far as research can tell us at least. Do you support legislation? In many, many polls, the public opinion, often when answering a rather basic and straightforward sort of question, you know, do you support it or don't you support it, or do you think doctors should be allowed to assist people to die, generally say yes. And that can vary between about 60 to 75% in favour. So that has to be taken into account. However, slide number 23, it's worth remembering, and this is now being reinforced by the Select Committee, that we had over 20,000 submissions on this topic. 77% of those submissions, it's actually 80% according to the report, were actually against euthanasia. And so not all of these submissions came from members of the healthcare professions, remember. There will have been quite a lot of public submissions. And so the evidence actually shows us that the general public are not necessarily that supportive of legislation. In the Netherlands, slide number 24, a cross-section survey, now we're talking about nurses, by the way, and physicians rather than the general public, showed that there was ample support amongst nurses and physicians and the public for euthanasia. So in the Netherlands, they're now fairly convinced that after a period of time and a period of uncertainty and research that showed that uncertainty, they're now fairly convinced that their doctors and their nurses and their general public are more or less in agreement that euthanasia is acceptable, and there's greater support than ever before for, I'd say, advanced cases like advanced dementia and so on. So developments have occurred in that country that generally show an acceptance amongst the healthcare professionals. The same thing applies, slide 25, to Belgium. Although in Belgium the studies have been difficult, the one thing they haven't really been able to do terribly well is understand exactly what nurses and those assisting or taking part in euthanasia in a secondary fashion think about this particular topic, and there are several perspectives, such as those who support the procedural sort of perspective and those who support an existentialist perspective, an understanding of the patient's condition and so on. So in Belgium, in recent times, some of the research coming through has not necessarily been entirely clear, and there's still a lot of debate. However, to finish, and it is getting to that time, I do want to say that we have got research in New Zealand amongst doctors and nurses. One of the most controversial, I suppose, is the Oliver, Wilson and Malpass report from 2007. And this is a fairly extensive study that showed that 37% of doctors supported euthanasia or assisted dying in New Zealand, but 67% of nurses were supportive also. This report has been controversial for a number of reasons, though, and one thing to remember is that the authors themselves have said we use certain terminology in our study that may have influenced the participants in their expression of support or not. But the Oliver Wilson study is something which has to be taken into account. In my own case, I have done a small study amongst hospice-based nurses, as some of you probably know. This study is not necessarily an example of a complete nationwide study. It's only a small study. It started out as a pilot and became a slightly bigger study, but even then, the findings are to be seen with some care, because they're only generally indicative rather than major results. But certainly amongst hospice-based nurses, some of the findings were quite interesting. 100% didn't believe that using large doses of opioids was a form of euthanasia, as many nurses now would argue anyway. 80% have been asked by a patient or relatives to supply medication to cause premature death, and so it's a common problem that is faced by hospice nurses daily. 30% support changes to the law to allow acts of euthanasia under certain circumstances, and so that's an interesting figure. 16% would be willing to take part in legalized euthanasia. 11% perceive participation in acts of euthanasia to be an acceptable part of a palliative nurse's role, but most don't consider it to be part of any nurse's role, and so there is a sort of a trend there, but a minor one, I suspect. 9% have performed an act that they perceive to be an act of euthanasia. This is perhaps the most disturbing part of the research, but I think this means literally that they performed certain acts that they consider to be acts of euthanasia that could well include palliative sedation and acts like that. And this is where the confusion with terminology and the definition of euthanasia comes in, and where we're going to have to be much clearer about exactly what we mean when we use terms like euthanasia and assisted dying. Slide number 28 is just a reminder that most organizations around the country oppose changes to the law. Most organizations relating to medicine and palliative care, oddly enough and surprisingly to an extent, remaining neutral, generally speaking, is the New Zealand Nurses Organization, the National Nurses Organization, and the College of Nurses. None of these bodies, to some of our surprise, I must add, have actually come out in support of, say, the New Zealand Medical Association or anybody else opposing changes in the law. The nursing associations seem largely to be remaining neutral. Slide number 29, essentially the last slide, I've just put in there, not really for discussion now, but as an example of how we might consider responding sometime in the future, because in my opinion, whether euthanasia legislation is going to be passed or not, there's still going to be the issue of requests made within our services for acts of euthanasia, and we're going to have some sort of way of responding to this issue. There are some documents now that have been appearing over in recent years that are helping to deal with this issue. One of the main arguments, as in box one, is that there are many factors that influence the request to hasten death, and if we understood what these factors were and spent time trying to respond to these factors, in box three for instance, then we'd be better prepared to deal with these situations. However, I notice the time is now 20 past 8, doesn't time fly, so I'll end my presentation at that point and hope that you can maybe read these slides later on if necessary, and certainly look at the Select Committee report, which will, I think, fill in a great number of gaps, of which there are still quite a lot to consider. So I'll hand over now to everybody else.